I'm Harry Glerkian, and this is Moneyball Medicine, the interview podcast where we meet researchers, entrepreneurs, and physicians who are using the power of data to improve patient health and make healthcare delivery more efficient. You can think of each episode as a new chapter in the never-ending audio version of my 2017 book, Moneyball Medicine, Thriving in the New Data-Driven Healthcare Market. If you like the show, please do us a favor and leave a rating and review at Apple Podcasts. For every drug candidate that makes it all the way through the three phases of clinical trials to win FDA approvals, there are about 20 others that fail along the way. Phase 2, where drug makers have to prove that a new drug is safer or more effective than existing treatments, is where a lot of drugs falter. But often, it's not because the drugs don't work. Sometimes, it's just because they weren't tested on the right patients, meaning patients in the treatment group didn't happen to have the right genes or gene expression profiles to respond. If you could find enough patients who were likely high responders and try your new drug just on them, your chances of approval might go way up. The tough part is identifying those subpopulations in advance and matching them up with promising drug compounds. That's where a company like Aransa comes in. It's a Palo Alto startup that has built an AI platform called the Smarter Engine. The engine uses public datasets on gene expression to identify subtypes of molecular diseases and predict what kinds of compounds might work against specific subtypes. Aransa used the engine to discover a drug for liver cancer that's about to enter clinical trials, and it's licensing out some of the other drug candidates that it has in process. Some of the ideas baked into Smarter Engine come from a subfield of artificial intelligence called hypothesis-free machine learning. And joining us this week to explain exactly what that means is our guest, Peck Lum. She's a biochemist and molecular biologist who worked at the microarray maker Rosetta Informatics and the software company Iasdi before founding Aransa in 2014. And she says one of the real revolutions in drug development is that almost every disease can be divided into molecular subtypes that can be treated using targeted drugs. Peck, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
You know, I always try to ask this opening question when I start the show to give the listeners a good idea of what your company does, but you guys are in drug discovery. What tell us, help people understand, what is the basic approach that you guys have? And I'll get into the special sauce later, but what do you guys do in the drug discovery space?
You know, that's a really great question in the sense that, you know, when we first started, you know, about 5 years ago, you know, I've always been in the drug discovery field in the sense that I worked for, you know, over 20 years ago at that time in a company called Rosetta Informatics, which is really kind of, you know, pushing the cutting edge of thinking about using molecular, you know, data, right, and to solve the mysteries of biology. And I was extremely lucky to be one of the core, members in when we were very small. And then that really kind of put me in the sense, put me in the stage where I could think about more than just one gene, right? Because the technology was just kind of getting, really kind of, you know, I would say not rolling forward, like propelling forward with microarray. Then with
yes.
So I was part of that whole movement, and it was really amazing, to be, kind of like, in the show as it runs, and so to speak. And then Merck bought us after we went public, and I worked for Merck and Co. for another 8 years, really learning how we should apply technology, how we can apply technology, molecular data, RNA data, DNA data to a drug discovery pipeline. And really kind of figured out that there are many things, that the pharmaceutical world does very well, but there are many things that it also fails in, and that, you know, how can we do it better? So I've always been in the mindset of, when starting Aransa with my co-founder, how do we do it better? And not only just do it better, but do it very differently so that we can address the most, I would say, critical problems. So Aransa is really a company started by us to address the problem of why drugs actually fail a lot when they go into a phase 2 efficacy trial. right? It's not like the drug is, you know, kind of bad or toxic. Most of the time is you can't find enough responders to make your clinical trial, you know, a success. And right. That's because, I guess, you know, drugs are actually made, you know, to maybe against one target. You don't really think about the biology that much at the beginning or the biology responders. So Aranza is really created to think about first the heterogeneity of the disease and the heterogeneity mm-hmm. of patient response. So we start from looking at molecular data of the disease from the get-go. We take, you know, RNA is really, the RNA world is, you know, it's coming back with the vaccines and, you know, as right. we know. But RNA has always been fascinating because it tells you about the activity of a cell, of a normal cell versus a disease cell. So we use RNA transcriptomes, right? Transcriptomics, you know, to study the biology and the heterogeneity. So our algorithms, we have many algorithms. One of the first algorithms of the engine is really to look at the biology of heterogeneity, whether we can subdivide a disease into more homogeneous categories before doing anything.
Right. Yeah. Well, I remember when I was at Applied Biosystems, I remember Applied Biosystems, some Affymetrics, and then Stephen Friend starting this. And like, you know, it was all starting back then. And I want to say we sort of had an idea of what we were doing, but compared to now, it's like, wow, how naive we were back then compared to how much this whole space has evolved. And it's interesting you mentioned, you know, RNA and its activity, because in a couple of weeks, I'm actually going to be talking to a spatial genomics company so that you get a better idea from a visual standpoint of which cells are actually activating and which aren't. But so you've got an interesting professional career. And I say that because you were working at a big data analytics company for a while that was utilizing an approach that was hypothesis-free machine learning, where the machine was sort of identifying unique or aspects that you should be paying attention to, maybe, that it was seeing, that instead of you going in there saying, let's just look over here, you could see what the machine was seeing for you. How much, can you tell us a little bit about that experience? And then how did that influence what you're doing now? Because I have to believe that they superimpose at some level.
Right. I think, you know, you know, ever since my first job at Rosetta and then my subsequent jobs, you know, really culminated into this, you know, into this package you see today, right? You know, all this experience and certainly experience, you know, while being a founding member, you know, a small team at that time, you know, of IASD, which is the software company, you know, has been, you know, also an eye opening, you know, experience for me, because we were trying to create, you know, using a very old mathematical idea called topology or TDA, really, you know, start to figure out whether there's, you know, maybe there's some things that can't be learned, right? And so typical machine learning methods, you know, need a training set or a testing set, but there are just some things where you don't really know what the ground truth is. So how do you do that? So that's the idea of, like you said, a hypothesis-free approach, and you know, the approach that this deep tech company, the software company that we built, is really around the idea that not everything can be learned, but you can actually adapt some very interesting ideas around a hypothesis-free approach and then use it in a machine learning or an AI framework. So I definitely, have been influenced by that thinking, as we built the software, right? And also when we were at Rosetta, we were generating in parallel, you know, data on thousands of genes. And often at that time we were called, oh, you're just going fishing. You know, but sometimes going fishing is not a bad idea, because you don't really know which part of the ocean you need to go to catch your blue marlin, for example, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Fish a little bit, you know, not the whole ocean, but, you know, to get some, I would say, boundaries, right? So in that sense, to me, a hypothesis-free approach gives you the boundaries where you can look. So, you know, so the experience, definitely, you know, the idea that, you know, you can use methods or thinking or algorithms that could help you in a field where you do not know the ground truth, like patient heterogeneity. I would say nobody really can pinpoint and say, or can say that, oh, this is the subtype, these are the markers, and therefore, I'm going to go, after this. And there are many, I guess, for example, you can think about Herceptin as a great example, right? You know, mm-hmm. When we first started, it was like, wow, okay, you're going to go after a target. And, but then the idea of really kind of subtyping, say breast cancer, mm-hmm. Started, I don't know, 20, 30 years ago, right?
Yeah.
And we're still learning about, patient heterogeneity, and we're just beginning to scratch the surface. So for Aranza, we wanted to use a method very much like the thinking that, and the idea that we had, when we were, when I was at Yazdi, is that, you could search with some parameters, a very complex space without needing to say, this is my hypothesis, this is that one gene. Because we all know that if you have a target, to respond, you need the target. But if you have the target, it doesn't mean you're going to respond, because things below the target or above the target are much more complex than that.
Correct. And I always feel that there's, I always call them low-hanging fruit. Like the first one is, okay, well, it's either luck or skill, but I got to one level. But then you start to see people that are not responding. So that means something else is going on. And there's subtypes, right? So it's funny how we always also call it rare diseases in the smaller population. I'm pretty convinced that at some point, everything is going to be a rare disease, right? Because of the subtypes that we're going to start to see. I mean, even we're seeing it in neurological now. Alzheimer's. Okay, but there's subtypes of Alzheimer's. No, really? Shocking. Amazing to me that there's subtypes, right? We've been dealing with this for ages. And I do believe that these technologies are so good at highlighting something where a human might not have seen it, might not have understood it. I was interviewing, actually, I just posted it today on imaging in agriculture. And they were saying that sometimes the machine sees things that we don't fully understand how it sees it, but it sees it and points it out, which allows us now to dig into it and be able to sort of identify what that unique feature is that the machine has pulled out. I'm not sure I want drug discovery and drugs being based on something we don't fully understand, but the machine highlighting something for us that then we can go dig into, I think is an interesting greenfield space that that we need to explore more.
Right. I think you're absolutely right. You know, when we first started Aranza, that was the idea that we had. And then my co-founder and I thought, what if we find like hundreds of subtypes? We're never going to be able to make a drug against hundreds of subtypes, especially starting out. So let's hope we find small enough number of buckets that we can say, this is approximately what it looks like. That be able to be practical to find drugs against those subtypes. So when we talk about subtypes, we are talking about, you're absolutely right, it's like a leaf on a tree, and that we have to cut it off at one point enough right. that the machine thinks that, okay, this is homogeneous enough that yes. you can actually make sense out of it. And that's where the engine, that's what the engine does. Basically, it takes data, very, very complex data, things that we could never figure that out ourselves, and say, these are approximately 5-6 buckets. So we've actually not found hundreds of subtypes. Otherwise, we probably would not have started Aranza, because that would have been impossible. But instead, we find not N of one, but maybe, 5 to 7 subtypes at most. That is enough for us to say, the machine says, okay, it is homogeneous enough, go for this. So that's kind of where we start at Aranza. And I think that's an important concept, because people often thought about precision medicine as being, oh, I'm going to make a medicine for you and you only. But actually, right. you can learn from, say, breast cancer, and that's approximately people with, estrogen receptor positive tumors. Right. And then you will likely respond to a drug like tamoxifen, And even though we know that the response rate is only about, I think, maybe 30-40%, right? But that's really good, at least at this point. So that's kind of where we, how we think about the engine as a shining the light on a homogeneous enough population that we can actually do, make a drug against that.
Yeah. So that sort of leads us into, you have this technology that you've termed SMARTR, S-M-A-R-T-R, engine, right? What does that stand for?
You know, that's my one of my rare occasion where I put my marketing hat on, because I'm not a marketer at all. And we, so S, and you notice the M-A-R, is, big M is A-R. So it's for subpopulation.
Yes.
Markers, targets, and redefining, because I needed to be smarter.
Okay.
So it's S-M-A-R-T, you know, and an R.
So I'm and when you like when you've described this in the papers that I've looked at, it's a machine learning, mathematical, statistical approaches, highly automated, and totally runs in the cloud. So can you give us a little more color on the sort of the highly automated, and why is that so important?
Right. It's important because it comes from my own experience of working with like amazingly talented, you know, bioinformaticians and, you know, data scientists, you know, at say at Merck, or, you know, or I know how it goes where, you know, biologists will often ask them for something and they would run their magic, you know, and they give us an Excel sheet or a PowerPoint. Right. And sometimes, and it's always, a lot of times it's one-off, right? One-off this and one-off that, because, you know, biology is kind of one-off. So the idea of us building this engine is not just equipping it with algorithms. So first of all, we don't have one algorithm, a hammer looking for a nail. We have a problem to solve. The problem is how to find novel drugs, drugs that never people have never thought about, you know, for patient populations that will respond. So with that in mind, we built a pipeline of algorithms that starting from thinking about heterogeneity to understanding preclinical models that reflect the biology of human subtypes, to predicting drugs and targets for those and getting biomarkers for the patients when we go to the clinic. And we have different algorithms for each step of the pathway. So instead of having my team do a one-off thing, we know that if we don't do good software engineering, and it's going to be problematic because first it's going to take a really long time.
Right.
Can things will be kind of higgly-piggly in Excel sheets, and you know we might be able to solve, you know, one thing, but to do this as a platform and as a pipeline builder, it would be impossible without good engineering practices. So we wanted to put this in a framework where, you know, everything is connected. So where, you know, it gets to run faster and faster through better algorithms to better software engineering. And this really kind of came from, you know, my experience too, you know, at a YASD, a software engineering, you know, a software firm, and also my co-founder who's, you know, who is a physicist and a software engineer, that we need to have, you know, good software practices. So what we did was we built, first, we don't want any servers. Everything is done in AWS and it's done in modules. So we create algorithms, you know, for each part of the pipeline or the in silico pipeline. And then we have in such a way that when we take data in, when we ingest data, that's also automated. And then by the time it ingests data and it spits out, I would say, you know, what subtypes of disease, what biomarkers could be used in the clinic, what targets are interesting to you, what compounds from our digital library of compounds may be effective for that. Everything is more or less connected and could be done up in the cloud. And now it finishes in about 24 hours.
When do humans look at it to say, makes sense? Maybe we need to tweak the model a little, right? Because it's not making sense. When does that happen?
So it happens at several steps. So, you know, within our engine, we've actually have benchmarks in there that we run periodically. You know, for example, we have about, about eight data sets that we have 8 to 10 data sets that we have for breast cancer, thousands of, patient tumors. And we know approximately that, you know, it should be discovering, and it has discovered, you know, ER plus flavored subtypes, you know, ERBB2, HER2 plus subtypes, triple negative subtypes. So that is kind of like the rails that we put in into our engine as well to make sure that when we actually do tweak an algorithm, it still has its wheels. What we do is at this point, we generate out, all the in-between data, but it's kept on the cloud. And once it's up, when it outputs the list of things, the biologist, actually the biologist with a knack for computation will look at it, you know, and I myself look at it. I am actually, I love to do data analysis, you know, in my spare time when I'm not doing CEO stuff, you know, and we can see, then we will look at, once it's done that, it also allows you, okay, so this is an interesting one where the engine on the cloud outputs all of this. And right now, you know, let's say, you know, my CSO, you know, who's not, you know, a computational person, or me or whoever, you know, really kind of, you know, would be kind of a big pain to kind of go up and, you know, install the stuff and look at the things, something you can't see. So what we did as a company is to build another kind of software, which is a visualization software.
Right.
On top of that. So we have on our other end, a visualization software that we call Apollo, you know, because it's exploring, that basically connects everything the smarter engine has done into something that's visualizable, that is, you know, is a URL, we go to it. And let's say, for example, my CSO wants to know, okay, the last one you did on head and neck cancer, you know, how many subtypes did you find out? What is the biology? What's the pathway? What's the log fold changes of things, you know, and it could do all of that by him just going there and looking at things. Or he can actually type in his favorite gene and then see what the favorite gene actually is predicted for, how it behaves across subtypes, across over 30 diseases, and he can do that all at his fingertips. So we have that part of the engine as well, which is not the engine. We call it Apollo, which is our visualization platform.
Right. Well, it's funny because one of the first times I interviewed Berg Pharma and they were talking about their system, I was like, oh, if you put on a pair of VR glasses, could you see the interconnectivity and be able to look in a spatial? I was on another planet at the time, but it was a lot of fun sort of thinking about how you could visualize how these things interact to make it easy, because human beings, I mean, you see a picture. Somehow we're able to process a picture a lot faster than, you know, all this individual data. I think I just slow down. I'd rather look at a visual if it's possible.
It is so important because, you know, even the engine is extremely powerful now. It takes it, you know, 24, you know, hours to, you know, finish, you know, from, you know, data input to, you know, kind of spitting out these information that we need. Visualization and also, like you say, interpretation and just kind of making sure, you know, kind of like the human intelligence kind of keep an eye on things. Visualization platform is so, so important. That's why, you know, I feel like, you know, that we did the right thing in taking time, putting a bit of resources to make this visualization platform for our preclinical team, who actually then needs to look at it and go, okay, these are the drugs that are predicted by the engine. Can we actually have an analog of it, or does it have development legs? Does it make sense? Does the biology make sense? And so now we've basically connected everything. So you can click on you can find a drug in our database and it will pop up, you know, the structure. And then it will tell you, hey, this one has a furan ring, so maybe you might want to be careful about that. This one has, you know, a reactive, you know, oxygen moiety. You might want to be careful about that. So we have, you know, as we grew the visualization platform, we got feedback from the users. So we put more and more things in there, such that now, it has, you know, little visualization modules that you can go to. And if you ever want to know something, I don't have to email my data scientist, you know, at 1 a.m. in the morning saying, hey, can you send me that Excel sheet? that has that particular thing on it that I want to know from 2 weeks ago, I can just go to, Aranzas Apollo, right? You know, as long as I have Wi-Fi, right? And be able to be self-sufficient and look at things and then ask them questions if things look weird or, you know, talk to my CSO and say, hey, look at this. This is actually pretty interesting. And this one can be accessed by anybody, you know, at Aranza, you know, as long as you have Wi-Fi. So
it's software development and drug development at the same time, right? It's interesting because I always think to myself, if we ever like went back and thought about how to redo pharma, you'd probably tear apart the existing big pharma, other than maybe the marketing group, right? Marketing and sales group. You tear apart the rest of it and build it completely differently from the ground up. It was funny. I was talking to someone yesterday at a financial firm and good friend of mine, and it's her new job. And she's like, my job is to fully automate the back end in the middle and go from 200 people down to 30 people because we're fully automating it. I'm like, well, that sounds like a really cool, I'm not really thrilled about losing the other 170 people, but with today's technology, you can make some of these processes much more automated and efficient. So where do you get your data sets that you feed your programs?
Yeah, let me tell you this. We are asked this a lot of times. And, you know, just kind of coming back again from my background as a, you know, as an RNA person, right? One thing that I think NIH and CBI did really well over 20 years ago is to say, guys, now we're no longer doing a one gene thing. Yeah, we have microarray. Soon we're going to have, you know, sequencing. There's going to be a ton of data. We need to start a national database, right? That it will enable for anybody that publishes, to put the data into a coherent place. And even with big, projects like TCGA, they need, things that could be accessed, right? So I think it is really cool that we have this kind of, I would say repository that unfortunately is not used by a lot of people because, everything goes in, right? That's a ton of heterogeneity. So right. For us, when we first started the company, before we even started, the company, we thought about, okay, where is it that we can get data? We could spend billions of dollars generating data ourselves, pristine data, but then it would never represent what's out in the clinical trials, what's out in the in the human world, which is the wild, wild west, right? Heterogeneity is abundant. So we thought, a repository like GEO, like Gene Expression Omnibus, right? Mm-hmm. And AMBL or, TCGA allows this kind of heterogeneity to come in and allows us the opportunity to actually use the algorithms, which actually are the algorithms that we look for. We've actually used to look for, heterogeneity and put them into homogeneity, these kind of data sets. So we love the public data set. So because it's free, it's generated by a ton of money that is just sitting there, and it's got heterogeneity like nobody's business. Like, you could find a cohort of patients that came from India, a cohort of patients that came from, North Carolina, a group of patients that came from Singapore, and from different places in the US and different platforms. So because the algorithms at first that studies heterogeneity is actually, I would say, platform independent, platform agnostics, we don't use things that are done 20 years ago or they're done yesterday. And what we do is we look at each one of them individually, and then we look for recurrent biological signals. So that's the idea behind looking for true signals, because people are always saying, oh, you go fishing, you may be getting junk out, right? So let's say, for example, we go to the engine points to a spot in the sea, in the ocean, and, five people go there and you're always fishing out the same thing, the blue marlin, then you know there's something there. So what we do is we take each data set, runs it through our engine. The engine says, these are the subtypes that I find. It does the same thing again in another data set and says, these are the things that I find. And then it looks for recurrent signals, which means that if you are a artifact, that came from this one lab over here, or some, kind of, something is unique to this other cohort over there. You can never find it to be recurrent, unless it's a very weird systematic bias, So because of that, we are able to then very quickly, I would say, get the wheat and throw away the chaff, right? And basically, by just looking, by the engine looking for recurrent signals. So public data sets is like a treasure trove for Aranza because we can use it.
So you guys use your engine to, I think you identified something unexpected, a correlation between a plant-derived flavonoid compound and the hearts. I think it was, you found that it helps mitigate toxic effects in a chemotherapy drug. Can you say more about how the system figured that out? Because that sounds not necessarily like a brand new opportunity, but identifying something that works in a different way than what we thought originally.
Right, exactly. So I guess, it is. So in our digital library, let me explain a little bit about that. We have collected probably close to 500,000 gene expression profiles. So it's all RNA gene expression based. And we have, representing about 22,000 unique compounds. And these are things that we might generate ourselves or they are in the public domain. So any compound that has seen a live cell is fair game to our algorithm. So basically you put a compound, could be, Merck's compound, could be a tool compound, could be a natural compound, could be a compound from somewhere, and it's put on a cell and gene expression was captured. And those are the profiles or the signatures that we gather. And then the idea is that, because remember we have this part of the engine where we say we're going to take the biology and study it, and then we're going to match it, or we're going to look for compounds or targets when you knock it down whose gene expression actually goes the opposite way of the disease. Now, this is a concept that is not new, right? In a sense that over 20 years ago, I think Rosetta probably was one of the first companies that say, look, if you have a compound that affects the living cell and it affects biology in a way that is the opposite of your disease, it's a good thing, right? Yeah. It is a good thing. So that's the concept. But the idea then is to do this in such a way that you don't have to test thousands of compounds, right? So it's accurate enough for you to test a handful, and that's what we do. Right. And by putting the heterogeneity concept together with this is something extremely novel and extremely important for the engine. And so with this cardiotoxicity, it's actually an interesting story. We have a bunch of friends who spun off a company from Stanford, and they were building cardiomyocytes from iPSC cells, induced pluripotent stem cells. And they wanted to work with us, saying that, why don't we work together on, a cool project? We were just starting out together. And we thought about this project where it is a highly unmet medical need. Even though chemotherapy works extremely well, anthracyclines, it actually takes, the heart takes a toll. There is toxicity, and it's a known fact. And yes. There's only one drug in the market, a very old drug in the market today, and there's not much attention paid to this very critical aspect. So we thought we can marry the engine. At that time, we started off with oncology. We still, we still are, in oncology. And they were in cardiomyocytes. So we decided to tackle this extremely difficult biology where we say, how does chemotherapy, affect, heart cells? And what does the toxicity look like? So the engine took all kinds of data sets, heart failure data sets, ischemic stroke, cells that's been treated with anthracyclines. So a ton of data, and look for homogeneity in signals of the toxicity. So this is a little bit different from the disease biology, but we're studying toxicity.
Yep.
And we then ask the engine to find compounds that, that we have in our digital library that says that what is the I would say the biology of these compounds when they hit a living cell that goes the opposite way of the toxicity. And that's how mm-hmm. we found we gave the company probably about seven to 10 compounds to test. They can't, so one thing that's really great about our engine is that you don't have to test thousands of compounds, and right. It's not a high throughput screen because technically it's already screened it in silico. And mm-hmm. then it would choose, a small number of compounds, usually fewer than 30. And then we're able to test and get at least, a handful of those that are worth looking into. And that has what mm-hmm. we call developmental, development legs. This iPSC cardiomyocyte system is actually quite complex. You can imagine that to screen a drug that protects against, say, doxorubicin, it's going to be a pretty complicated screen that can probably very, very hard to do in a high throughput screen, because you have to hit it with dox, and then you have to hit it with the compounds you want to test and see whether it protects against a readout that is quite complex, like the beating heart, right? Mm-hmm. And so we gave them about, 7 to 10, and actually 4 of them came up to be positive. Pretty amazing. Out of the 4, one of them, the engine noticed that it belongs to a family of other compounds that look like it. So that was really another hint for the developers to say, drug developers to say, this is interesting. So we tested then a whole bunch of compounds that look like it, and then one of them became the lead compound that we actually out-licensed to a pharma company in China to develop it for the Chinese market first. We still have the worldwide rights to that. So that's how we tackled toxicity. And I think, you might have read about our other project with Genentech, actually, Roche.
Yes.
We have a poster together. And, and that is also the same idea that if you can do that for cardiotox, perhaps you can do it for other kinds of toxicity. And one of them is actually GI tox, which is a very common toxicity. Some of them are rate limiting, that you can't, you might have to pull a drug from a clinical trials because there's too much GI tox, or, it could be rate limiting to that. So we are tackling the idea that you can actually use our engine to mm-hmm. create drugs that are, an adjuvant for a disease, saving drug that otherwise could not be used, properly, for example. So that's kind of one way that we actually use the engine, just starting from this little project that we did with the spin out, basically.
So basically the engine is going in two directions. One is to identify new things, but one is to, repurpose something for something that wasn't expected or wasn't known.
That is right, because it doesn't really know, it doesn't read papers and know it's a repurposed drug or something. You just put in it, basically, yes. The gene expression profiles or patterns of all kinds of drugs. And then from there, as a company, we decided on two things. We want to be practical, right? And then we want to find novel things, and it doesn't matter where that comes from. As long as the drug could be used to do something novel or something that nobody has ever thought of, or it could help save lives, it's we go for it. However, we could find something. We were lucky to find something like this flavanol that has never been in humans before, so it still qualifies as an NCE actually, because it's just a natural compound. So in that sense, I would say, maybe it's not repurposing, but it's repositioning. I don't know, from it being a natural compound to being something maybe useful for heart protection. Now, for our liver cancer compound, it is a totally brand new compound. The initial compound that the engine found is actually a very, very old drug. But it was used for a completely different thing and definitely not suitable for cancer patients. The way it's is delivered.
This is the AU-409?
Correct. So AU-409 yes, okay. is an entirely new entity, new composition of matter. But the engine gave us the first lead, the first hit Engine told us that, we analyzed over 1,000 liver tumors and probably over 1,000, normal controls, found actually three subtypes, two of them the main subtypes, and very interesting biology. And the engine predicted this compound that it thinks will work on both big subtypes. We thought this is interesting. But if you look at the compound, it's been in humans, it's used, it's an old drug, but it could never be given to a cancer patient. And so our team, our preclinical development team, basically took that and said, could we actually make this into a cancer drug? So we evaluated that and thought, yes, we can. So we can basically, we analogued it. It becomes a new chemical. Now it's water soluble. We think, we want to be given as a pill once a day for liver cancer patients. So that's how we kind of, as each of the drug programs move forward, we make a decision. The humans make a decision after the engine changes to that and say, can we make it into a drug that can be given to patients?
So where does that program stand now? I mean, where is it in its process or it's in its life cycle?
Yeah, it's actually we are GMP manufacturing right now.
Okay.
It's already gone through a pre-IND meeting, so it's very exciting for us, and it's got a superior toxicity profile. We think it's very well tolerated. Let's put it that way. Could be very well tolerated, and it's at the stage where we are in the GMP manufacturing phase, thinking about how to make the drug product and so on.
So that begs the question of, do you see the company as a standalone pharma company? Do you see it as a drug discovery partner that works with somebody else? It's interesting because I've talked to other groups and they start out in one place and then they migrate someplace else, right? Because they want the bigger opportunities. And so I'm wondering where you guys are.
Yeah, we've always wanted to be, we describe ourselves as a technology company, a deep tech company with a killer app. And the killer app is drug discovery and development, right? Drug discovery especially. And we've always, thought about our company as a platform company. And we were never shy about partnering with others from the get-go. So, so with our 018 drug, which is a cardioprotection drug, we out-licensed that really early, and it's found a home, now it's being developed. And then we moved on to, our liver cancer product, which we brought a little bit further. Now it's in, kind of GMP manufacturing. And we are actually looking for partners for that. And we have actually a prostate cancer compound, in lead optimization that we'll probably partner out as well. So we see ourselves as being partners, either we co-develop or we out-license it. And maybe one day, hopefully not too far in the future, we might bring one or two of our favorite ones into, later stage, clinical trials. But, but we are not shy about partnering at different stages. So we are going to be opportunistic because we really have a lot, to offer. And also one thing that we, we've been, talking to other, partners or entrepreneurs is that using our engine to form actually other companies to really, make sure the engine gets used and, properly, leveraged for other things that Aranza, may not do because we just can't do everything.
No, that's impossible. The conversation I have with entrepreneurs all the time. Yes, I know you can do it all, but can we just pick one thing and get it across the finish line? And it also dramatically changes valuation, right? Being able to get, I have people that tell me, one of these days I have to see one of these AI, systems get something out. And I always tell them, if you wait that long, you'll be too late. So here's an interesting question though, and jumping back to almost the beginning is, the company was named Capella and you changed the name to Aranza.
That's right.
And so what's the story behind that?
Oh gosh, when we
somebody woke up one morning and said, I don't like that name.
It's actually pretty funny. So we like to go, you know, to the Palo Alto foothills and watch the stars with the kids. And then one day we saw this Capella. From far, you look at it, it's actually one star. You look at it closer, it's two stars. You get closer, it's four stars. It's pretty right. remarkable. And I thought, hey, we should name it Capella Biosciences, right? Thinking we are the only ones on the planet that named, you know, so we got, you know, Capella Biosciences, you know, and then probably, and then we never actually had a website yet. So we were just kind of chugging along early days. And then we realized that there was a Capella Bioscience across the pond in the UK. Like, what? How can somebody name it a Capella Bioscience without an S? So I actually called up the company and said, hey, we are your twin, you know, across the pond. We're doing something a little different, you know, actually completely different, but you are Capella Bioscience and I'm Capella Biosciences. What should we do? And they're like, well, we like the name. We're like, well, we like the name too. So we kind of waited for a while. But in the meantime, I started to think about a new name in case we need to change it. And then we realized that one day we were trying to buy a table, you know, one of those cool tables that you can use as a ping pong table that also doubles as a conference room table.
Okay.
So we called up this New York City company and they said, oh yeah, when are you going to launch the rockets into space? We're like, what? So apparently there's a Capella space.
Ah, yeah, okay.
Well, that's the last straw. That's it. we are changing because we get people, you know, tweeting about using our Twitter handle for something else. And so it's just a mess. So we've been thinking about this other name and I thought this is a good name. And AU means gold.
Yes.
Chemistry. ANSA is actually a Latin for like opportunity, you know, which we found out, you know, we're like, oh, so golden opportunity, golden answers to kind of fits into the, you know, the whole platform idea. Oranza, you know, sounds, you know, feminine. I like it. I'm female CEO. And I can get oranza.com. That is
okay.
Like,
and well, there you go.
Nobody has Oranza, you know, and so that is how Oranza came to be.
Well, you got to love the, you know, I love the Latin dictionary when I'm going through there, when I'm looking for names for a company. I've done that a number of times. So, well, I can only wish you incredible success in your journey and what you're doing. It's such a fascinating area. I mean, I always have this dream that one day everybody's going to share all this data and we're going to move even faster, but I'm not holding my breath on that one when it comes to private companies. But it was great to talk to you and I hope that we can continue the conversation in the future and watch the progression of the company.
Same here. Thank you, Harry. This has been really fun.
That's it for this week's show. We've made more than 50 episodes of Moneyball Medicine, and you can find them all at my website, glorikian.com, under the tab podcast. You can follow me on Twitter at HGlorikian. If you like the show, please do us a favor and leave us a rating and review at Apple Podcasts. Thanks, and we'll be back soon with our next interview.